Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every weekday from 11 a.m. to noon, and you can also reach us at restaurantguysradio.com, and you can also find our show podcasted through iTunes Podcast Alley, where if you go there, you can have our show sent to your computer automatically every time we upload a new show. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Francis. Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing really well.
That's good to know.
Fun. I learned earlier, or last week, I should say, that most of the cocktails that I like don't have a lot of calories. That was big news for me because some of the cocktails out there have a gazillion calories.
This is the leftover homework from the Bill Grimes show we did, isn't it?
We did spend some time talking about cocktails with Bill last week.
We did a show with Bill Grimes, who is the... he was the restaurant critic for the New York Times for a long time. He's also a columnist on beverages mostly, but also on food. And we talked with him about his book primarily, Straight Up or on the Rocks, The Story of the American Cocktail. And Mark did a little research that he didn't get into the show.
Yeah, I got this
and we want to talk about it today.
This article from Forbes.com was some of the article. It was really creepy, some of the things, like the frozen pina coladas and frozen margaritas.
Yeah.
How many calories do you think that a frozen pina colada has, say?
I don't think it's a diet drink, if that's what you're wondering.
Okay, well, think lunch, okay?
How much is it?
644 calories in a pina colada.
644 calories, that's the same as, say, a couple of burgers?
Lunch.
A couple of McDonald's burgers?
It's an unbelievable amount of calories for one drink, and you're going to have five?
No, I'm not.
Okay, I'm sorry, but just to put this in perspective, 3,000 calories is considered a big diet.
Yeah.
So four or five of these, you can't eat.
That's
it. That's all your food. You're done.
That's called alcoholism, Mark. So if you're anybody who's planning on the margarita or the pina colada diet, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, something that I think some people don't realize is that alcohol itself has a fair amount of calories. Around $100 an ounce. $100, funny.
In our place, maybe.
around 100 calories an ounce, thereabouts. A little bit less for most things.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sometimes it's the mixers that really get you. But there are drinks like Cosmopolitans and Mojitos. Which, while they have a mojito has a little bit of sugar in it, doesn't have that many calories.
Well, how many calories does a mojito have in it?
An average mojito has about 160.
That's a lot better than the 644 for the pina colada.
Yeah, which is about the same as a beer, which is fairly close to a glass of wine. Most of those things come in around that level. You know, a light beer comes in at about 100 calories.
You know, I like pina coladas.
And
going for walks in the rain. And I like making love at midnight.
You know what?
What?
You disgust me.
Midnight's a little early for me, actually. I'm a morning kind of guy.
Too much information, pal. Too much information.
I am a morning kind of a guy. Anyway, I think it's very interesting to look. I didn't realize there was that big a discrepancy between, 700 calories if you drink something. I mean, what's a White Russian? That's way up there, too, right?
White Russians are up in the 500s. It's amazing, and you know what capped the list, and this one surprised me, because while you know it's got a lot of different things in it, you don't recognize how many calories it might have.
Yeah,
a Long Island iced tea.
Oh my God,
780 calories. That was the big winner, or loser, however you look at it.
Why would one drink one of those anyway?
Yeah, it was 1982.
And you were trying to get drunk fast?
I was 17 years old.
Oh, my God.
You know how it works.
I used to work behind the bar, and I'd make those things, and I'd think to myself, now, why are you doing that? It's just all this stuff together. It doesn't taste like anything.
It didn't taste like anything. That's exactly why we did it, because it didn't taste like anything.
I don't know. I'm not...
It seemed like a good idea at the time.
If you're a young person, and you're just, you're just sort of discovering the world of the cocktail, you're just sort of discovering wine...
Francis says, have a Pimm's cup.
Are you saying that I'm effete? Are you saying that I'm effete? No, I'm saying that, look, that whole rite of passage get drunk thing, that doesn't really have anything to do with the finer things in life. You know, it's a
Yeah, but sometimes it helps you get there. Sometimes you do have to cross that bridge.
I don't think you do. I don't think that you do. But I think that we talk about wine and cocktails and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about enjoying them in moderation. It's
of course.
About
of course.
And you don't have to spend a lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, getting up. I mean, there are good bottles of wine you can have for like $7 to $10.
Yep.
And as a young person, you know, it's funny. We travel a lot. We travel in Europe a lot.
Right.
You know, if you're 21 and you get, if you become a drunken idiot and you're Spanish in mm-hmm. Spain, people look at you like you're
people
an idiot.
People make fun of you, sure.
You know, in Italy or in France, you don't get drunk and
yeah. The object is to stay in control. That's anytime you're out of control, you've lost.
Yeah,
sure.
That's exactly right. Anyway,
sure.
So when we talk about cocktails, and we're talking about using them in moderation, having mm-hmm. them with food. And you know what? When you're not driving, if you go out and maybe drink to where you're over the legal limit once in a blue moon, I don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that using alcohol in moderation and in moderation is the key. It's shown to be beneficial to your health.
Sure, but you want to stay in control.
It's better for your lifestyle. And when you're drinking less, and when you're not drinking 37 beers to try and get drunk,
mm-hmm.
You can buy a good beer, you know,
right.
and have a couple of good
beers. And that's what we're doing in this country. We're drinking a lot less and we're drinking a lot better. That's the total trend of the alcoholic beverages in this country.
And I think it's really unfortunate that with younger people who we have that rite of passage thing when we mm-hmm. turn 21 or even kids who drink underage. You know, it's unfortunate that we have that in this country, because in countries that don't even have a drinking age or don't enforce their drinking age.
Right.
You find that we don't have that.
Right, and you don't have to go through that.
You don't have to, like, hey, everybody out there, if you're 20, about to turn 21, if you're, you know, just about to start experimenting with mm-hmm. having alcohol as a part of your life, keep it in moderation. Have it be a part of the evening. You know, those Animal House is funny, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, people, it gets dangerous stuff
when
you don't use it properly. And it's one of the most wonderful things in your life if you can keep it in moderation.
For sure. So, you know, there's one other drink that I adore, especially in summertime and late summer and early autumn, and that is a watermelon martini.
Oh, fabulous drink.
It's, we've talked about this cocktail before. Just simply fresh squeezed watermelon juice, a little bit of Absolute Citron we use. You can use Ketel One Citron, vodkas like that. Very, very simple, half and half. And that cocktail only has 125 calories.
And here's how you make it. When you make a watermelon martini, you see, watermelon juice doesn't keep. It'll turn rancid in 24 to 36 hours. So what you do is you juice a watermelon with one of those hand wands, or you can squeeze it with your hands, I don't know, just mm-hmm. get the juice out of the watermelon somehow. And that juice will keep refrigerated probably for 2 days. And just fabulous. 50-50, throw it in a cocktail shaker, shake it up with ice real cold.
Mm-hmm.
So it winds up, and you know, it's a 4 ounce drink. You want to pour a 4 ounce drink for a single cocktail. Wonderful, cold, and light in calories.
So, Francis, if you're drinking 3 Long Island iced teas a day,
yeah.
at whatever 2,400 calories or whatever that comes out to,
you have.
I think you have no right to sue your doctor if he calls you fat.
Yeah, did you see that?
It's been in news for a couple of weeks.
Where the woman went into her doctor and her doctor said, "Listen, you're really obese," and she filed a complaint against him.
Yeah.
But she was really obese? I mean, legally, medically, she was fit the characteristic of obese?
Okay, here's the rule. If you're obese, it's your doctor's job to tell you you're obese.
Yeah, I mean, that's really crazy.
And here's another rule. If you don't like the way your doctor talked to you about being obese, go get another doctor.
Shut up and go to a different doctor. Hey, let me tell you something else. If you're working on 4 Long Island iced teas a day, obesity is the least of your problems. I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
much.
That's true, too.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we are here talking today with a friend of ours who owns a winery in California. Now, Norm Roby in Decanter Magazine, which is a British wine magazine, writes of Vineyards 7 and 8, which is the name of the winery. He writes, "Each month it seems another dozen new wineries appear on the California scene. Sadly, many end up tasting like they come from a cookie-cutter school of winemaking. But every now and then, a new kid on the block has something distinctive to offer. Lonnie Steffens is the owner of Vineyards 7 and 8. He wandered into our restaurant stage left a couple of years ago, and as wine lovers are wont to do, we've become quite friendly over the years, and his wine's just terrific. He stopped in last week, and we shared a bottle of his terrific wine, and we kidnapped him and made him come on the radio to talk with us today. Hi, Lonnie.
Hi, Lonnie. Hey, how are you today?
Good, Francis and Mark. We ought to have a little fun today.
I think we will. I was really impressed with your wine when you brought it in the other day. And it's not something you see around too often. And now, you've come into the wine business rather late. And there's an old adage in the wine business that goes, if you want to make a small fortune in the wine business, you should start with a large fortune. Is this true?
I think it's absolutely true. This is certainly a labor of love and something one has to look at as a hobby.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's probably not as bad as owning a boat, but...
I was just about to say, a lot of winemakers compare it to owning a boat.
Right. But I think that, you know, while I've come into the business relatively late, I started drinking wine in 1967, so I've been drinking wine for a long time, and so we've been doing this since 99.
So now, Lonnie, you have you didn't just go into this halfway, okay? You bought 15 acres up on Spring Mountain in Napa Valley, some of the most expensive vineyard land in all of California, and some of the most exciting vineyard land in all of California. Why did you choose that area in particular to start your little venture?
Well, I have a view that, you know, there's this French word called terroir.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably a big advocate of the concept that the land and the ability to grow great grapes is one of the most, if not the most, critical factor in making a superior wine. When we began to look around, we basically listened to the big debate about, you know, the mountain and the valley, so to speak, and we tried a bunch of wines and came to the conclusion that we really liked the kinds of things that people were doing in the various mountain areas within Napa, and so this became, you know, what we decided to do.
I was going to say one of the things that you notice, I think, as soon as you go out to that area of California, that it seems like the most important and most exciting wines are grown up in the mountains, and the higher the elevation and the steeper the slope seems to be where the great wines come from, and the kind of more mundane or average style wines seem to be grown on the valley floor.
Well, in fairness, there's probably some exceptions to that.
Of course, there's always exceptions to every rule.
But my sense is I agree with that, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to do it. And, you know, I originally, when I decided that this was something that I was interested in, I really wanted to make as a good a wine, as world-class a wine as we possibly could make. And so I felt that if you were going to do that, you couldn't do it with sort of a mediocre acreage. And so we felt that this acreage was available. The vines had been planted by David Abreu in the late 1980s. And so at the time they were about 12, 13 years old. And we felt that gave us, you know, a very high likelihood that we, you know, had the capability to produce something special.
Well, and, you know, for our listeners who may not realize, because not everybody's a wine drinker, but it's sort of fascinating as a business and as an agricultural product and as a lifestyle. But when we talk about why wines would be different if they're grown up on the mountain, really great wines come from the grapes. And the grapes really reflect the weather and what goes on. And we all know that the higher you go up on the mountain, the weather changes. It gets a little cooler. The air gets a little thinner. You go in Napa, you go above the fog line, and everything changes. And how that's reflected in the grapes is very fascinating in that very often the growing season is slightly different because you get cooler nights, which extend the growing season, which leave the grapes on the vine a little bit longer, which changes the way that the grapes taste. And you get a lot of sunshine up there. They say that up on the top of Spring Mountain, you get sun about an hour earlier. The fog burns off. You know, they don't have to wait for the fog to burn off, so you get another hour of sunshine a day. Well, this all translates into some very special stuff in the bottle. And if you go and look at wine bottles in the wine store, you'll see people bragging about on their back labels to say, we're 2,500 feet above on the Rutherford Bench. We're how high up in the mountain. And that's a relatively new thing. It's also more difficult to farm up there, isn't it, Lonnie?
Well, you know, it is, because the elevations and the slope of how some of the vines are planted. In fact, half of our vineyard probably couldn't be planted today because of new regulations. But I think that you're absolutely right. And actually, my experience out there is we probably get sun 3 hours longer than some of the places in the valley on any given day.
That's pretty extraordinary. We're talking to Lonnie Stephen, who's the owner of Vineyards 7 and 8 in Spring Mountain District of Napa, California. And we're talking about his great wines and his well-reviewed wines that we like a lot out there. And we'll be talking with him more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 1125.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today our guest is Lonnie Stephens, owner of Vineyard 7 and 8, who made the big mistake or great fortune of wandering into our restaurant one day and becoming friendly with both Francis and me. Lonnie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Lonnie, just a moment ago we were talking about your vineyard site and why you chose it. Can you tell us a little bit more about the land that you've chosen up on Spring Mountain?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that's kind of fun, it's basically, at least on the Napa side of Spring Mountain, it's the highest point in Spring Mountain at 2,020 feet in terms of elevation. You know, we've spent a lot of time trying to go, we did 200 soil samples to look at where we thought there were the right nutrients and where some of the nutrients that we thought could give it consistency across the whole vineyard and where there had to be some additions to bringing those up to more normal. And so over the last two or three years, we've been in the process of trying to make sure that that's been accomplished. And we think that every year that we've had the vintage, we think that it's gotten better and better because of some of the attention to detail that we've done with that.
When you say you do soil samples and you really analyze the soil that's going on there, I mean, we're talking about going into the vineyard and analyzing what's in each part of the soil, and that's sort of using technology, but it's using technology to sort of be able to grow wine in an old-fashioned way, isn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, what we were trying to do is take a look at sort of the, what I guess I would look at is the health of the vineyard, and look at where we thought we had to make some additions and make sure that the grapes and the vines could grow best in that kind of an environment.
What kinds of things have you needed to add to the vineyard?
Well, we added some areas where we didn't think it was getting enough water, so we changed some of our watering mechanisms because what happened was at the top of the hill, the water system that was there when we got there didn't go all the way to the top as effectively. We also looked at adding some compost that created what we felt was, you know, a healthier vine and a better growing vine, and we did some pruning of some vines that we felt probably were better not there, and we've added some new ones back in their place. So it's been a sort of an ongoing four-year process to really make sure that the vines were tended to and the ground was tended to.
We're talking with Lonnie Stephens, who's the owner of Vineyards 7 and 8 in the Spring Mountain District of Napa, California. We'll be back to talk with him more after the news. Central Jersey 1450, time is 1130.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or just through restaurantguysradio.com, or podcast us on iTunes, Podcast Alley, or one of the many other podcast sites.
Hello, Lonnie.
Hi, Francis.
Now, Lonnie, we were talking about your wines.
Today we're talking with Lonnie Stephens, owner of Vineyard 7 and 8. We were just talking to him about his wines just a moment ago.
In Napa, California. Now, your wines, a lot of these big wines, and your wines are fairly expensive, and it's very ambitious because it's very expensive to do what you've done and buy the land where you've bought the land and be building a winery where you're building a winery. And what we find in most of these, what people call cult Cabernet Sauvignons, is they're these big, powerful, inky black wines.
And the idea behind them is to get a big score.
And your wines do score very well in the publications, but your wine's a little different than that. It's a little more reserved. You didn't quite go for as much power. Wasn't that risky? Wasn't that a risky thing to do?
Well, we felt that what we were really trying to do was really sort of make a traditional Cabernet, and at the same time take advantage of the California growing season and the California kind of wine that adds to the sweetness because of the sun. But we felt that having the really high alcohol content really took away from some of the inherent flavors. And mm-hmm. so we felt that it was better to attempt to provide a wine that was a little more food friendly and in some cases wasn't so overpowering in terms of what you were having at the meal. And we thought that that made sense. And we also thought that this might be a way in the crowded market to differentiate ourselves mm-hmm. from many of the others.
Now, weren't you afraid, though? I mean, those big wines always get are more likely to get big scores from Robert Parker and from the Wine Spectator. And I mean,
that can do a lot for wine. It can do a lot for what you can charge for the wine. It can do a lot for people wanting to find them.
And not getting a big score can hurt. Weren't you afraid of bucking the trend there, Lonnie? I'm glad you did, by the way. I like your wine a heck of a lot better than those.
Well, look, I think you're absolutely correct. I mean, I think that having a terrific score has a very big impact on the bottom line. I just think that ultimately maybe there will be some changes so that the type of thing that we're doing will be maybe more widely recognized and appreciated.
Well, I hope so, and I think it's a style of wine that you do see appreciated in Europe, and historically has been very important. But it's sort of under assault, and it's really nice to see you doing it out there.
So Lonnie, I just want to know, how did you get from and you spent in a former life, you were a big corporate bigwig. How do you get from there to here?
Well, you know, it's a long story, but to make it fairly simple, I had been very active in some unique wine dinners that we had done for charities in New York. And as we did more and more of them, I sort of came to the conclusion that it would be really nice to be involved in something that was really special and that you could maybe make very special. And so had an opportunity to chat with someone about whether or not I could either be an investor in one of the higher quality Cabernet producers in Napa or start something on our own. And
you don't strike me as a guy who just wants to be an investor passively.
I think that's probably true. So we decided that we would begin the process of trying to really make something interesting and unique, and I think we're making progress. It clearly doesn't happen overnight. And I think that building a reputation and a name, like any business, takes a longer period than any of us sort of entrepreneurs would like.
Right. What now? Has your lifestyle changed at all since you have the winery?
A little bit. After I left corporate America, I started an investment advisory business, so I still spend the vast majority of my time doing that. But fortunately, we have both clients and investments in California, so I'm out there, you know, 4 or 5 times a year, and it gives me an opportunity to do some entertaining at the winery and really combine it into my business.
That's great. You know, Lonnie, it's pretty cool that you've done something that a lot of people talk about doing, and we wish you a lot of success with that.
Well, my hope is that we can come back in and try the Cabernet with the best hamburger on the East Coast.
Dave's Left Restaurant, that's exactly right. Hey, Lonnie, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for being with us today, Lonnie.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Have a great
Bye-bye.
Day. Bye. So, Francis, it really is interesting what Lonnie's done out there. I mean, leaving the whole corporate American experience and going out to California where things are much slower. And
yeah.
I think that's a big life change.
You know, I like it out there, Mark, but I really respect it out there, but I couldn't do it. I need to be near New York or Paris or Madrid.
That's because you're a little bit crazy, a little frenetic.
A little freaky, things. But it's beautiful out there, and one of the things that's very interesting when you go out there is everything is slower. People are generally nicer. I think it's harder to make friends out there than it is out here. Maybe that's just because I'm a rude East Coaster.
I was going to say, that's because you say something acerbic and they walk away.
No, people are nice to you out there, but it's harder to form relationships. Now, L.A., of course, is just abominable. Like, I can't stand it at all. I mean, everybody's fake. Beautiful, but fake.
I'll tell you, one of the things I love about California is it is beautiful. The weather is gorgeous. I mean, I've talked about my aunt has a house out in Santa Cruz. And we go, and you can literally pick lemons all year long.
Yeah.
And it's really just a nice, very agricultural-friendly area.
Well, and that's the thing about it that people don't realize, is that that in different areas of California, again, I'm talking outside L.A., you can get really very in tune with the agriculture. And one of the nice things, because we have spent on wine buying trips and such, we spent a lot of time in Napa and Sonoma, and... You know, the farmers, it's not just grapes that grow out there and around there. It's the restaurants are very farmer market driven. We have a market driven restaurant out here on the East Coast, but, you know, April is the cruelest month, baby, because it's hard to get seasonal stuff all year round. In California, you know, we often mock California produce out here. We say, oh, well, that's California tomato. Well, see...
Because it had to travel 3,000 miles to get here.
Right, those are the California tomatoes they ship to us. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of great stuff that they pick ripe out there, and boy, you can eat well out in California.
I mean, literally, the growing season in California is, in areas of California, is 12 months a year, and as you move farther and farther north, that gets a little bit shorter. But you can get local produce in areas of California for 11 months a year.
Well, and people have mocked this. You know, why do you make fun of California produce and Florida produce? I don't make fun of California produce and Florida produce. If you're in California or Florida,
right, precisely.
You know? But what they ship is not what you get. You know, I'm sorry, what they eat there is not what they ship out. We're talking about the big agribusiness farms in California and Florida, where they make produce that's designed to be shipped away, which means it's not designed to have the most flavor. It's designed to be durable. And also, we believe in supporting your local farmers wherever you are. And if you're out in California and you're supporting some local farmer out there, you're going to get the best food, and you're also going to keep your farmer on the land, which is a way to make sure that your kids can have the best food after you.
I've had the good fortune of going to the farmer's market in Santa Cruz a couple of trips out there. And it's just a great big marketplace, and people get together, and you can tell it's very similar to the farmers markets that we have here, in that the purveyors know their customers. They know what their customers are looking for. You can ask your purveyor to get you something, what's coming up, what's super fresh.
A lot of people
tasting things. It's really interesting.
People too nice out there. Sorry, can't do it. I need the changes. I also need the change of seasons. I need the snow. You know, I need the fall is beautiful, and it's always nice out there. It can't be always nice.
Yeah, but then what do? You go out to the mountains and you do your skiing out there. It's really nice on the West Coast, and I could see myself spending 2 months a year out
there. Mark, you just said, and you do your skiing out there, like what I missed was the skiing. Like, Mr. Athlete over here. I like to sit in a bar and watch the snow come down with my brandy.
Listen, there's nothing like a hot cocoa after a day on the slopes.
I just go for the hot cocoa. I totally agree with you.
No wasted time or effort on your part, huh?
I did used to ski when I was younger, but I don't know. I don't do it so much anymore.
Less time, that's why.
Well, I'll stick in the East Coast. You can retire to the West Coast. You can go out and join Lonnie, but I will go out there it's a great place to go and do business, and it's a great place to go for a while, but I'm just an East Coast boy. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, welcome back to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. We were just talking to Lonnie Steffens, who is a former bigwig at a huge multinational corporation.
He's still a bigwig wherever he goes, man.
But now he's making wine, and it made a big change. I think that's really interesting change in life there, change in life choices.
I think it's interesting to look at, you know, now his wines are very expensive. Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting to look at those wines at the expensive side. I mean, we don't drink, they're not everyday wines, but it's important to look at what people are doing to sort of push the envelope, and I think that often has really good implications for the wines across the board that can be brought in. And I think his wines are very good, and he's making some real strides in quality. So we'll leave it at that.
I think it's also a fun life change to say, you know what, I'm giving up the whole corporate
fast-paced thing,
and I'm going to go spend some time on my vineyard. And he doesn't live on the vineyard full time, but still, I think very interesting.
I think the rule of thumb is that it's good to be Lonnie Steffens.
So Francis, nice, I want to talk about some stuff I've been reading.
Yeah.
We are slowly but surely, now we've talked about exterminating pretty much wild Atlantic salmon. We're slowly but surely.
Let me give you the background. Just so everybody knows, there is no commercially caught wild Atlantic salmon anymore. We fished it out of existence. So there, any Atlantic salmon you get, it's a different species, the Atlantic salmons, than the Pacific.
There are very, very few wild Atlantic salmon.
You can sport fish them.
But generally you won't see them commercially, period.
No, there's no commercial fishing of Atlantic salmon, period. End of story. We already caught them out of existence.
Well, there's a new study out on the Pacific salmon now that they will be virtually extinct by 2100.
Yeah.
And again, that's not because of overfishing now. This is a whole different problem. But as we encroach on their territories and more of our runoff and we change the flow of rivers and the things that go into the rivers, more and more we're going to slowly exterminate salmon, and that's just a fact of nature.
Those of you out there of a certain generation will remember a movie called Soylent Green. And I didn't want to go there, but maybe we'll have our Soylent Green. We'll recycle our dead people and eat them, because that's all we're going to have left. You know, the thing about salmon is, it's just like Mark said. Now, with the cod fishery was knocked out of existence because we overfished cod, right? Simple. Easy to understand. But the salmon is the canary in the coal mine, everybody, because the salmon starts its life in little freshwater babbling brooks at the top of a freshwater stream.
Right.
And then it swims down these rivers, and it goes out into the ocean and travels thousands of miles, and then it comes back to the very self-same stream.
And that's exactly the problem. The problem is this salmon has to have a habitat that is contiguous.
Right.
From one space to the other.
And if you mess up the ocean, the salmon dies. And if you mess up the river, the salmon dies.
Or if you mess up one little part of the river, the salmon can't go through it and can't spawn.
Yep.
And that's exactly the issue. The issue is the salmon won't be able to make its run all the way back and forth.
And I don't know. It speaks ill of our... What will they think of us when our grandchildren link back and think, there were more than four kinds of fish, you know?
You don't think they're going to write the Greatest Generation book about us?
I don't think that's coming about us, man. I think that was my dad.
You don't think we get that?
No, I don't. It's amazing to me how we can do things when we know it's happening as it's happening.
Well, we
throw up our arms like it's some sort of natural catastrophe. Global warming. Can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
We're depleting the fish stocks. Well, what are you going to do? Can't stop fishing.
I just read this they caught this giant catfish. I'm not even sure which country it was, but this giant, like, 800-pound...
Thailand.
In Thailand. 800-pound catfish, giant, you know, there are... You know, we used to catch 100 of them a year, and now we catch, like, 2 of them a year. Stop catching them.
Yeah.
Stop catching them. What do you mean you used to count... And literally, in the article, it's like, yeah, they used to be abundant. We'd catch these giant fish. This is the biggest fish that they've ever caught. But, we used to catch these big fish all the time, and now we hardly ever see them anymore.
Stop catching them. Leave them alone.
Stop catching them. Although I do have to say, what they do when they catch them now, by law, they have to take them to the government office, and then they harvest the eggs and they're trying to bring these fish back that way. So then what happens is the fish almost always dies, and they cut it up and eat it. So here's my rule. If you're a fish and you get to be 800 pounds, you won.
Right, leave him alone.
Okay, you won.
Leave him alone. Wait till he dies of natural causes, and then they catch food out of him. But, you know, Mark, it's this myopia that people get about environmental issues that, like I said before, they think it's as if there's nothing that can be done about it. I mean, the Atlantic cod fishery collapsed and will never be a commercial cod fishery again.
Right.
And we knew it was happening as it was happening. And the scientists were saying it's happening, and if you keep fishing this way, Gloucester, New England, you're going to lose this forever.
This commodity. And that's what it is. Realize that it is a commodity, and we understand that Francis and I aren't stupid about this. We understand that it's a commodity, but if we told you that gold regenerates if you don't take too much of it,
right,
would you take it all?
Right. That's exactly it. And it's like people say, oh, well, you know, the ecologists are against the economy. No. The ecologists have a long-term view of the economy because they wanted the cod to still be there. And you can't fish cod today because we didn't pay attention.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with the Oglala Aquifer, which is an aquifer in the southwest, which they said for years, you're taking too much water out. If you take this much water out, it won't regenerate and it will run dry and it will salinate. Guess what? The Oglala Aquifer is now running dry. So 15 years ago, the people around there said, well, we can't stop farming around here. We can't stop building and doing development over here. We have to keep taking water out. Well, you know what you have to do now? You have to either find a different place to get water or stop farming.
You need to truck in your water is what you need to do.
But they could have made that decision 20 years ago, mm-hmm. or 10 years ago even, and still and be in a much better situation than you are today.
Well, we're in the same situation with oil right now, and I don't want to go down that road.
It's just, it's all short-term thinking, and we need to think long-term, and we need to eat well. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. You're back with The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis here, talking about wine today, talking about food and fish and treating our planet well today, and let's talk about something ridiculous for just a moment or two.
Welcome to my life.
Did you see the headline? This is in the New York Times, September 6th. KFC spends big to market chicken dipped in sauce. That's right. The Kentucky Fried Chicken Corporation, looking to set itself apart from burger chain rivals, encroaching on its turf with major marketing campaigns that entail serving chicken with sauce on the side, KFC is now serving the chicken already dipped in the sauce for you.
How lazy do you have to be to not want to dip your own chicken in the sauce?
I thought dipping it in the sauce was
part of the fun. I thought it was part of the thing.
What's wrong with us?
We're lazy.
Oh, my goodness. Lazy.
You know, of all that whole chicken dipped in sauce thing, you see the new chicken fries that Burger King just came out with.
Please tell me.
Chicken fries. They are this chicken food. It's hard to call it chicken because it's not actual chicken.
It's chicken that's mealy, awful chicken that you get. You've seen that
extruded commercial where they do the extruded turkey and they show you how most turkey's made. Well, that's how these chicken fries are made. It's chopped up into a tiny little paste and then they squirt it into this mold and so it's exactly the right shape. Yuck. Yuck. Anyway, these chicken fries, okay, they've turned them into French fries because our tastes have gotten so bad that our kids no longer will eat anything but the French fries.
That's impossible.
So to get them to eat the fried chicken that's horrible for you, but slightly better for you than the French fries, they shape them like French fries now. So
my mother had a different philosophy. I remember the times that I would pray for a dog, you know, when we would have liver, and we didn't have a dog.
My mother once gave us carrots with the crinkle cut carrots shaped uh-huh. like French fries.
Uh-huh.
I was like, I was whatever, 8 or 9 years old. I'm like, Mom,
that's not a French fry.
Not a French fry. That's You're not a, fooling me.
That's a carrot. Oh, I don't know. Make your kids eat vegetables. You know what? I'm sorry, kids out there listening, but your parents should make you sit there and eat your vegetables. And even if you don't like it, you'll grow to like it when you get older.
Put a little butter on it. It'll be all right.
Exactly. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.